tell me, what's your impression behind the original story of COVID-19, that this came out of a wet market, and or what they're starting to say now about the Wuhan lab? They're bringing that back out.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty simple question to answer, because xenotransplantation is really accelerated zoonosis. Because viruses and pathogens jump species, you know, all the time in nature, but it usually takes millions of years. So when they say this is a natural zoonosis from a seafood market, a person doesn't cook the food or whatever it is, gets infected and then transmits it to someone else. That doesn't happen for maybe 800 years, because bat viruses need an intermediate host. They need a gain of function. You won't go straight from the bat to the human, because you'll kill the human. And then, as we discussed earlier, the virus can't afford to kill its host. It has to live with it. It has to hide there and make more reservoirs. So the zoonosis that occurred with COVID-19, that gain of function where it looks like it comes from the family of SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, slash COVID-2. This is another virus in that family that has somehow emerged to acquire the ability to infect human cells. And essentially, the only way that happens in a decade and not in 30, 40, 100 years for that event to happen again is by way of the laboratory, which is, of course, right there. So I don't use the term engineered, because that's a different term when you're a molecular virologist and you're making chimeras. You're intentionally putting a different cap on the nucleic acid of a different virus. And I don't think that's what happened at all. But anytime you take the animal into a laboratory and take the virus out of it and grow it in other cell lines, then that changes it. So you accelerated the viral evolution, the zoonosis, way, way, way rapidly. And then how did it get to 190 countries in what's said to be a month or two, which doesn't fit the biology of the situation, when it came from one woman and most people didn't come in contact with that market, or many that were in so-called ground zero, the laboratories are that manipulation and growing these cell lines, which, by the way, we ship around the world. And in that study, talking about the emergence of SARS-CoV-2, how it emerged, how it came out into people. The funding was done by the NIAID, and in the material and methods of that scientific paper, you'll see that they grew the virus. They replicated the virus, made large stocks of viruses in vero, the monkey E6 cells. So monkeys are close to humans. So you've acquired another ability. And if you want to think about the HIV sequences that are in the new SARS-CoV-2, that gives it expanding ability, not just to infect the epithelial cells and things, but to infect white blood cells, because GP4, the glycoproteins from HIV are going to stick like Velcro to white blood cells. And now you can start seeing COVID-19, the disease, looks like a retroviral disease, because you've given it access. You've given it the ability to infect white blood cells, which coronaviruses don't do. And this is why it almost has to be a lab-emerged zoonosis. NIAID funded the collaboration between the University of North Carolina and the Wuhan Laboratory. And they got the cells, the cell line, Vero E6, from Fort Detrick, from USAMRIID, from their biosafety level 4 facility. So it went back and forth from the U.S. North Carolina, the U.S. Fort Detrick, and Wuhan biosafety level 4 facility. And what most people won't remember, but we do because our colleagues still work there, is that the USAMRID biosafety level 4 facility was shut down for safety concerns in late 2018 or early 2019. And there were safety concerns at the Wuhan facility as well. So the chance that these things could get in the water, in the feed, in the food supply, it's not imagination. There's a very real possibility that happened. So what I show you is my laboratory and the 8-ball, the bioweapons laboratory, which is right here at Fort Detrick. Here's my laboratory on the top. Our biosafety level 3 facility is right above that staircase. And right back behind it is what we call the 8-ball. That's where they used to gas animals and do other kinds of bioweapons thing. And the USAMRID is literally right across the field from this location. And so my friend Mike Hugo, and it's a story in the book, actually did a large environmental law case, because some of the families outside Fort Detrick with the water supply, with the soil contamination from Fort Detrick, had as many as 22 different kinds of cancer. You know, breast cancer is in a single family. So he had done an environmental law, and of course it was all dismissed, and this was only 3 or 4 years ago.
Could you just briefly describe the gain of function work that you were doing at Fort Detrick on Ebola? In science, they attack you for saying that, you know, you were making Ebola more deadly or more infectious. But really, what it seems to me, the idea of the studies you were doing was so that you could then be able to study the best ways of protecting against it. Is that correct? Is that why you were doing gain of function with Ebola?
I did 2 studies. It was a collaboration between the National Cancer Institute and the U.S. USAMRID, U.S. Army Research Institute of Infectious Disease. So what we were doing with Ebola then, the simple thing is, if you can't grow a virus, you can't study it. Viruses don't, you know, they have to grow in cell lines. So what my first job was to find a cell line that the Ebola Zaire strain, which was a highly pathogenic strain, find a cell line that it would grow in without killing. And I develop cell lines, you know, for 40 years now, and understand how viruses grow and those immune mechanisms we've talked about. So among those that I chose was the Vero monkey, the Vero E6 cells. Why? Because it has no type 1 interferon pathway. And so it's a virus factory for RNA viruses, because the front line of silencing the virus, stopping its expression, is that. So yes, I was growing those, finding a cell line, I say teaching it to grow, to infect a cell without killing it. Because if it kills the cell, you can't study those mechanisms. And I knew those immune mechanisms because that's been my entire life's work. The second thing I did in those projects, and this was published in a separate edition of the journal Nature in 1999, and I believe I provided you with that publication of the short abstract of our studies for a meeting, was my job was to see what is the difference between the Ebola Zaire strain and the Ebola Reston strain, which was non-pathogenic, against that highly pathogenic strain. So I infected primary human monocyte. That's your frontline defense. That was my award-winning PhD thesis research in 1991, just 5 or 6 years earlier. So when you infect those monocytes and it becomes latent, and then you activate expression, what you get is, so we would infect primary human monocytes with the pathogenic strain and with the non-pathogenic strain, and ask what the cytokine storm is. What's the difference in signaling in immune response that makes a strain highly pathogenic versus non-pathogenic? And that happened to be the first time probably that we'd ever used. We probably didn't use the word cytokine storm. What we used is cytokine signature of disease, which is exactly what I did when I isolated from the patients in 2009, infectious XMRV. I didn't look at everyone with chronic fatigue syndrome or healthy people. I looked at people who had cytokine immune abnormalities, the inability to control the virus, and what the signature of disease was, at which we also published.
Bobby just mentioned the surfer on the beach. And, you know, one of the things that the journal Science has recently attacked you on is this, where you talked about, you know, how crazy it is to close the beach. You've got, and as I'm quoting you back, you said you've got sequences in the soil and the sand. You've got healing microbes in the ocean and the salt water. And you said, you know, it's insanity to bar people from that. And they say it's not clear what Mikovits means by sand or soil sequence. There is no evidence that microbes in the ocean can heal COVID-19 patients. So how would you respond to that criticism of theirs?
I didn't say that microbes in the ocean or the sand could heal COVID-19 patients, but microbes in the soil and the sand boost your immunity through your natural skin responses, along with the sun and the vitamin D and exercise, which is also immune boosting. So this is our natural way of developing a healthy immune system. And when you're sanitized and kept away from those boosting things, and in often cases, and most of what we're seeing right now, there is toxic cleaners. That's all we're breathing in our homes. So we're not getting sanitized. We're being exposed to, we're not getting exposed to the natural environment. That's what your immune system does. What's the difference between self and non-self? Many, many, many microbial sequences in the soil, in the sand, in the ocean, plants with natural healing properties that are absorbed through the water, through the skin. The skin is its own immune system. That's really all of it. So, yeah, let's just twist this.
Exactly, as a microbial sequence, just in a nutshell.
All of the little sea creatures, the little crabs along the soil, they all have DNA. There's microbes in the microbes. Plants have infections. Sand in the sand. There's natural antimicrobials. That's what plants are used for, and I develop drugs for them. So you're not boosting your immune system with the microbial natural sequences, natural products that are in the sea and the soil.
By sequences, you mean like genetics, DNA sequences?
Yeah, DNA from other plants, little creatures, everything. This is what I did for a living first in fermentation chemistry. That program harvested around the world plants and soil samples looking for antimicrobials, because for equilibrium in nature, you have microbials and you have natural antimicrobials. So being in the sand with the sequences, mushrooms, everything that's in, on the beach and in the oceans, half of what we did and isolated as anti-cancer drugs came from the ocean. So if we can't get in the oceans, we don't have the immune boosting, and we're not doing natural immunity in a natural way.
What's the name of your new book, and why did you write it?
Our new book is called Plague of Corruption. It published yesterday, and the subtitle is Restoring Faith in the Promise of Science. Right now, in our world, we have propaganda masquerading as science. So this is the only mask I will wear. It's from New Orleans. Now the public is wary of what scientists tell them, and we wrote it because it literally makes it looks like prophecy. We predicted this very event, and we started writing about it 4 years ago. We should have stopped everything October 8th, or probably even July 22nd, 2009. The invitation-only meeting, the "Oh my God, look what happened. Let's protect everybody." No, what did they do? They covered it up. They didn't make biosafety level 3 facilities. And in fact, they published over the next 7 or 8 years in Science, the journals. The journals are part of the propaganda problem. They published, unintended spread, release of a biosafety level 2 organism. No. The unintended release of XMRV was a contagious cancer-causing virus from mice to the world. We send those cell lines everywhere. So that's why we wrote the book, because the only thing we can do is show the world that this isn't what you think it is. We're not being told by our top members of the public health service who make a lot of money and trillions of dollars at taxpayers' expense. And the taxpayers get none of the benefits and they're actually killing them.
Redfield, Birx, Fauci, they were all in the kind of the early AIDS work. And they all, first of all, I don't know if you're aware of this, but a few of them, the current head of HHS, who's a lawyer, not a doctor or a scientist, and then, of course, Redfield, head of CDC, Birx, head of the plan, they're not only from that early AIDS period, but they're involved in very kind of right-wing fundamentalist Christian groups, and they have recommended, for instance, that, the groups that Redfield's been associated with feel like AIDS is God's revenge on the gays. And, there are very strange associations with these guys, and they seem to all be in a self-replicating, in a gang that's very self-supporting, mutually supportive. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on, just that unit that has stayed together for so many years from the AIDS days and is still involved in AIDS? Birx, Redfield, Fauci, how does that all work in the world of science? And they all seem to be very connected to the pharmaceutical industry. How does that work?
Well, they should be convicted felons for criminal fraud in these various papers and publications for 4 decades, for spreading HIV and killing an entire continent and an entire population.
How did they do that?
Well, because they get all the funding and they get all the publications and people like me go away. So they suicide us. There's an entire chapter in our book on scientists and doctors who are killed, who come up against them. So they do that because they have the control, they have the power, they have the money. If you don't publish in these journals, you don't continue your career. As I mentioned, I all my funding, my career is like it never existed. Now, as we testify in vaccine court, for the injured from vaccines, you've got the DOJ, the Department of Justice there victimizing the victims even further. And so a lot of what's in our book tells you how they do that. And so that's why they need to go away and literally be convicted of these 4 decades of crimes against humanity, because this is genocide. This is a Holocaust. And, they censor our data. They jail us. They kill us. They do anything they can, to stop this from getting out. But maybe they just, and what they say is, if anybody thinks about it, really, why does everybody, what public health measure could it possibly serve to take people off a beach or out of the ocean when they're bodyboarding alone? That has nothing to do with public health. It has to do with control and fear, and that we give up more of our rights as Ronald Reagan signed away our religious freedoms and our rights with the liability on all the vaccines. They're liability free. That's why they do it. It's a lot of money.
Can you just briefly tell what is VICA?
Oh, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Act, or VICA, is a federal law that Ronald Reagan signed in 1986 to remove all liabilities from manufacturers of vaccines. And again, Tony Fauci was standing right next to him saying, we won't protect you from the next pandemic if you don't sign this. Ronald Reagan at the time said it's unconstitutional and hoped the bill would change in a good way. That act removed liabilities liability, so you can't sue manufacturers, HHS, and the DOJ. So if I'm bringing a case because my child or my, you know, parents died from a flu vaccine, then there's no discovery. You go to this sham court. I call it a kangaroo court because there's no discovery. Nobody's at fault. And you simply, you know, they say, oh, the vaccine can never do that. Vaccines are presumed innocent at all costs, including literally destroying these families. And yet that program in the last 30 years has paid out more than $4 billion, probably closer to $5 billion, even though these special masters, not even really judges, really skew it and make certain none of these cases see the light of day and literally commit fraud in the case of the autism big collective group. It's called Ombudsman. Thousands of cases got together, and literally when it was shown in one of the test cases that vaccines did, by all the opinions of the experts, cause that child's autism, that the government paid them off big, silenced everybody, confidentiality, signed this piece of paper, never say anything again. And then they proceeded to throw every case that ever used the word autism, and now encephalitis or encephalopathy, brain inflammation. Tony Fauci lied to Congress February 27, 2019, and sat there and said the MMR vaccine doesn't cause encephalitis. And in fact, it does. And it's on the package insert from the manufacturer.
How safe and effective is the measles vaccine? The MMR vaccine. And how would you compare it to other vaccines?
Well, let's talk about efficacy first. It is clearly one of, if not the most effective vaccine that we have. It's as Dr. Messonnier said, you really can't get much better than that. That's the reason why we don't want to tinker with its efficacy. 97% is really, really good. And as both of us have said many times, it is a very safe vaccine. Over millions and millions and millions of doses that have been given, it is a very, very safe vaccine.
In my opinion, it's not a coincidence that in 2011, there was a case called Bruchwitz, and it's discussed in our book, Plague of Corruption, which basically removed everybody from liability, the drugstore clerk, anybody, you know, associated pediatricians, you know, any liability at all from injury. And of course, pediatricians make a lot of money from vaccines. They're paid very well with their vaccine program. So they will ruin your career and your life if you say a word. We have kids that got seizure disorders, developed seizure disorders from vaccines. And now here in California, their doctor had written, "You no more vaccines. They're susceptible to injury." And the public health of California overrules that now. And in order for these kids to go to school, they have to get vaccinated, and the next shot could kill them. When we had replicated Luc Montagnier's work and our paper was in press, Tony Fauci called me on the phone while Dr. Rossetti was out of town and told me to give him and Dr. Robert Gallo, a copy of our paper, which was confidential in press, basically so that they could copy the work. They delayed the publication of our paper, and Gallo came out with a paper of his own. And of course, this created a huge problem because many got infected while two countries literally fought over who discovered the virus. And this was the debacle in the 80s that Ronald Reagan presided over. So Tony Fauci...
Tony Fauci was not well loved by AIDS activists, in my understanding. Is that right?
Yeah, not at all. And you know, and not well loved by any of us in the work because, you know, it appeared that for monetary gains, you know, he's got patents on interleukin-2, which Dr. Frank Rossetti discovered. Why does he have patents on interleukin-2 therapy? So for almost a decade, that because he had those patents, the drugs that were made and the studies that were funded were to target the T cell. And again, it wasn't till my work in 1991 kind of exploded it, our work, Dr. Rossetti and our team, because Frank Rossetti was my PhD mentor, you know, that it was clear, that this was the wrong thing. So how many people died because Tony Fauci steered everybody to where he had a monetary gain in that situation? I think we can see that right now playing out in this. You know, we know that alpha interferon is not only curative, but can prevent the next round. So we're hearing about, oh, well, it's going to come back in a year. And until we have a vaccine, everybody locks down. Well, the things that should have been done to mitigate the infection was alpha interferon and the hydroxychloroquine right away to all the vulnerable. Do the right tests, the serology tests, to ask how long that virus has been there, and do we have a large population of people who will never get sick from the virus and have, in fact, neutralizing antibodies, which would be a vaccine as we grow those up and give those to the susceptible, which is what was done in the past. We've never made a successful vaccine despite trillions of dollars in HIV to HIV, and in 20 years, not to SARS or MERS. In fact, they accelerate the disease and kill more rapidly, and there are several publications on all of that.
Could you speak about I'm aware of those the studies that were attempted, even very pro vaccine schedule doctors like Offit and others have been very concerned about the possible, rushing a SARS vaccine because of those studies. But can you speak to a government study that suggested that those who had received the influenza vaccine were more susceptible to non-influenza pathogens like coronaviruses?
Absolutely. So that study, there were three studies that I came across with different kinds of influenza vaccines. But what it basically says is that there's a term called viral interference, that giving a flu vaccine would give you sort of a broad paintbrush protection for other kinds of upper respiratory RNA infections like coronaviruses. But the study that came out that was done in 2018 and 19 in military who had received the vaccines said that those people were 36% more likely to get SARS and more disease from it. And with other vaccines, there were three other vaccines that showed the influenza different formulations could enhance the pathogenesis even more, make people sicker if they got that vaccine. And so my frustration is that's what Tony Fauci came out and what is still being said by the CDC, get the flu vaccine because it'll offer you protection, when they absolutely know the opposite will happen.
If you look up Snopes or on Wikipedia or on, and there's a Chicago Tribune story, there's essentially what looks like hit pieces. They're very negative articles about you. And so could you just address how Wikipedia describes your case or Snopes or any of those kinds of organizations?
There's nothing that they say about what I supposedly did, that's true. They say, I was fired on September 29th, and I was fired for insolence and insubordination. But what Wikipedia said was I was fired because I didn't give a reagent that was accidentally shipped to my lab. Well, that reagent was purposely shifted to my lab, and it was intended use was to misappropriate federal funds of our grants and cover up what happened as the government carried out their threat. If I gave that talk on September 26, you know, my grants will be removed. You know, they didn't say it that way. But that, you know, I was threatened, and it's clear. I wrote the exact email in the book that I said to them, which was actually quite funny. I must have been angry. But at any rate, and basically they just carried out their threats, and they Watergate style broke into my lab, took all the key data, which is who is infected, what did the strains look like, where were the locations, so they could cover up the clusters, and just, you know, false arrest. No warrant, no nothing, but that's not what Wikipedia says. And the Chicago Tribune, when we got close, our family studies in 2010, which we gave at that NIH workshop, September 6th and 7th of 2010, it was clear in families where people had CFS or other cancers associated with the XMRVs, those families had kids that were susceptible to getting autism from vaccines. Wake up, this dormant, and it spread the reservoirs of XMRVs through the families. And that was what the data absolutely said. And then the Whittemores, whose daughter was cured with the very simple drugs that I mentioned, and by, you know, what clearly we isolated the virus from their very sick daughter. You know, I'm sure, although I don't know, you know, they threatened, you know, Harvey Whittemore had committed and is actually now a convicted felon for a campaign fraud with Harry Reid, who was then the Senate Majority Leader, is over Health and Human Services. So they
Who is Whittemore?
Harvey Whittemore.
Who was he to you?
He's the owner of the my boss. He's the founder and funder of the Whittemore Peterson Institute. That institute that we literally formed in 2006. My boss. He should have held the patent along with me and Frank Rossetti for the diagnostics. Think about these PCR tests. Well, he decided to use federal funds to manufacture tests that weren't validated and charge Medicare for them, which of course is fraud, in his own private company. And of course, so it's, you know, who goes to jail? You make Mikovits and the data go away, because she just gave the talk that said the viruses are real and proved that the molecular mechanisms behind it. So they just systematically, between Ian Lipkin, the Whittemores, and you can follow all of that in the journal Science. Even years later, 23 articles John Cohen wrote to basically beleaguered, you know, in a rare move, authors forced to retract, you know, a false positive. December 2011, they published a mugshot. They show Max Post, my student, who they also threatened with his life. They show him pointing to my notebook. This is supposedly a mugshot run in the journal Science. This isn't a mugshot. You know, that's that there. You can't take a mugshot if there is no crime. Never a day in court. Never anything. We had a case that.
Were you never charged? Were you never charged with anything?
Never charged. Never a day in court. Forced into bankruptcy. Had a case for, you know, racketeering and conspiracy. They call it QI-TAM, for wrongful termination and the destruction of my career and my reputation, against the Whittemores, against everybody at the university who keeps the funding. So you can always follow it back to Tony Fauci. Beleaguered Institute keeps funding, keeps grants. To this day, they get paid and they publish fraud. They published
this was funding that you and your partner secured for the institute.
I was the principal investigator. I secured for the institute more than $5 million in the 4.5 years I was there, and from a major diagnostic company, $150,000 a month, almost $2 million, to develop the blood tests based on what was in our original paper. Well, the Whittemores didn't have a contract with me. because I sign a shake hand agreement. When they asked me to come to the Institute, and I had another job offer to make biological therapies in cancer in San Francisco, they said, what do you want? And I said, I want a 5-year guaranteed contract because it's going to take me a while to put this together and bring the right people in to the, and build. We had to literally build the buildings, build the collaborations, do it quickly for everything I'd done in the biological response modifiers, and a signing bonus so I didn't have to sell my house in California.
But wait a second, Judy, just tell me, where, the majority of that funding, why is Fauci involved?
The majority of the funding was a grant from the NIAID. Tony Fauci. They kept the grants. That's another rare move. Never does a principal investigator lose their grants, especially when the institute they work for doesn't have a qualified principal investigator, and the institute itself was found to be misappropriating federal funds. So they're not charged. They keep the money in perpetuity to this day. Millions of dollars to the people. They were paid off to keep it quiet.
And Fauci, did you ever have any direct interaction with Fauci over this?
Oh, absolutely. That was the replication study. So that was funded, and I was not allowed on NIH property to do the study.
I'm sorry. So just make that just briefly more clear for me.
Oh, Tony, when in 2012, after I was fired, you know, I should have taken my grants to, say, UC Santa Barbara, where I am right now. I think any institution in as bad funding was in 2011 would have loved $5 million in indirect costs, which is, you know, $5 million to them. 100% is usually indirect costs for the institution to turn on the lights and supply everything that you don't use in the grant, like consumables. So he, you know, so that money, you know, I would have, if the replication study had been true, right and true, and we had proven there was XMRV in CFS patients and satisfied that association, which we would have done if Fauci had not stopped the study when we got to the only positive group and when Fauci forbade me from going into a lab. I did that replication study. I did virology by phone. I was not allowed in an NIH-funded lab and haven't been since that day.
But when you call it a replication study, that means you were trying to replicate the results from your first study?
Correct.
Is that the idea?
Correct.
And were you able to actually do that?
By
phone?
We would have. But Tony Fauci stopped the study when we found it positive. He said, I'm tired of wasting money. Literally, we'd gotten another year and all the way through it. And he stopped the study and applied a statistical program. And that's all in our first book, Plague. And it details, in fact, Ian Lipkin himself, who was, you know, paid by Fauci, you know, tens of millions of dollars for these grants. People get a lot of money for grant program. And Ian Lipkin said at the end of the book that they went back and looked at the Stanford samples from the Montoya study, and they found it almost exactly what we found, 80%. Positive. We would have confirmed, we would have, but he stopped it and then just ruined my career through the journal Science and the editorials. In 2011, when it became clear that the blood supply was contaminated, Tony Fauci literally, we had about $5 million in grants from the DOD with me as principal investigator at our institute, from the DOD and from NIAID. That's Tony Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. So I was, Tony Fauci directed basically the confiscation of my entire career, all of my notebooks, two offices, and all of my notebooks and computers. And then, once that was done, he was directing the so-called replication study that he directed Ian Lipkin to do, which when Francis Collins in 2010 found the blood supply contaminated, Francis Collins asked me, where did you get the negative controls in the UK? And I said, our colleague from the blood supply. So 4% in the blood supply is a big deal when HIV was never more than 0.1 or 2. So this was a really big deal both in Europe and here. So that's when Dr. Collins told Dr. Fauci, do a replication study, a very large replication study, and fund it from NIAID. Well, Tony Fauci directed Ian Lipkin to do this, where they literally just didn't put any of the patient groups, anybody that with chronic fatigue, except literally people they called who were tired out of the phone book. No, nobody with the inflammatory signatures, nobody with the things that we said pointed to the retrovirus as a causative agent for their disease. So that didn't trouble us all that much because, we knew there was one patient population from Stanford that was still in the replication study. And when the study started, Tony Fauci put an order out that said if I flew into NIH airspace, meaning I couldn't do the study in a laboratory. I'd been locked out of my laboratories, fired, and was literally here home in California. And all of my grants taken away from me later on. But basically, I was arrested as a fugitive from justice here in Ventura, California, and held there for 5 days with no due process, basically a story was made up and evidence planted in my house of those notebooks. Well, those notebooks with my handwriting is who are the people, who's in the study. So we refused even after all of that, even after the arrest when, without a job and everything taken away, we still refused to not proceed with the replication study because we knew we would be found to be right. So Tony Fauci just said I'd be arrested if I step foot on NIH. And you could, in 2016, 4 years later, I went to NIH to Fort Detrick to pick up a paper from the library. And when I walked in the security office, they said, I'm sorry, Judy, we have to detain you. You know, it says you're a fugitive from justice. So, this is, and that study came out as no, there's no association, XMRV, all a host, the Journal Science Commission fraud. They published the paper that was an association study in September of 2011 to cover up that the blood supply was contaminated. And essentially from that time, they've done everything they can to make certain that XMRV went away.
You know, the whole thing started then with Tony Fauci getting science to withdraw that study, not because it was wrong, but because Judy got arrested. And why did she get arrested? Because Tony Fauci used his political clout and to fool Harry Reid and to convince local police in California and Nevada that she had committed a crime by stealing materials from NIH. In fact, legally, and I'm an attorney, those materials, which were her notebooks, her hard drives, and all of her logs for that experiment, legally belong to Judy Mikovits. They didn't belong to NIH. She, under the federal grant, she, the researcher, who is the principal researcher in that grant process, has essential ownership of all of the materials that are created. So his accusation, at first he went to Judy and he said, look, this can all be settled. Don't worry. You got a great career here. You can stay here forever and you'll have a brilliant career, but you got to withdraw that article.
Did Fauci himself say that, or were it intermediaries?
No, it was actually the intermediaries, the funders, and the Ian Lipkin principally, others that were with regard to science and the studies that he funded, because he never never came to us. He's just the funder. It was $7 million to my institute, and he sent his grants administrators who basically said, you know, it'll be fine as long as you voluntarily retract the paper.
Tell me, did science ask you to retract your paper voluntarily? Can you just describe that moment?
So in 2011, when it was clear there was a real problem with so many disease associations, and when it was clear that the infectious molecular clone wasn't, you know, what was contaminated, that it was in fact these zoonosed viruses from vaccines in a contaminated blood supply. Science, the journal, came to Dr. Rossetti and I and asked us to retract the paper. Dr. Rossetti and I argued with data and quite cogently that the only data that needed to be removed from the paper was Bob Silverman's figure one, which showed that the infectious clone was not what the virus we isolated. Well, now Bob Silverman had the patent on VP62 and the viruses, so you understand in diagnosis, if that diagnostic test never found a single positive and our diagnostic test works, then of course we had the patent. So Science, the journal, agreed to only take that out of the paper and partially retract it, as the rest of the authors, everyone on the paper, agreed. When I gave the talk that they threatened me if I didn't renounce XMRV and turn the data back on September 22nd, 2011, if I didn't say there was no XMRV in the blood supply and that we had made a mistake, I would be ruined and beyond. So they carried out that threat as I gave the appropriate talk, and then they said we manipulated a figure in the paper which wasn't true, and they later found wasn't true. So basically, when I was arrested, Science, the journal, said we've lost confidence in the whole thing, and they forced the retraction against the authors, four of the authors on the paper.
There was an initial retraction, and then the other authors also retracted in some way or another. The journal, in 2011, the journal Science says, we note that the majority of the authors agree in principle to retract the report, but they've been unable to agree on the wording of their statement. It is Science's opinion that a retraction signed by all the authors is unlikely to be forthcoming. We are therefore editorially retracting the report. So is it true that your co-authors on the paper wanted to withdraw their support for the paper? And I guess if you could talk about what the partial retraction was at first, and then briefly what led to the other authors pulling out, if that's in fact what happened.
Yeah, that's what's most important, is the partial retraction. So throughout the studies we did, the reasons technically that some of that the studies were negative was because the virus was originally identified in prostate cancer, but only as sequences. So what was key to our 2009 paper was it was the first ever isolated isolation of infectious and transmissible virus, and showing that it could be secondarily infected into other humans and showing the spread of it through families and communities that were associated with the infected. What Bob Silverman and Joe DeRisi did was a technique where they only looked, a PCR technique, where they only looked at a small portion of the virus in the genomes of men with aggressive prostate cancer. So they then made an infectious molecular clone, a synthetic clone in the lab, and this was in 2005 and six, well before I even started my studies, but I did do prostate cancer drug development, so I was aware of this work when I was at the NIH working with Johns Hopkins. So at any rate, we
That clone, that infectious molecular clone, when we collaborated with him, once we isolated the viruses from the people, we sent it to Bob Silverman's lab to be sequenced. And so it was Bob Silverman's lab that on three different occasions failed to sequence the viruses we isolated as VP62 or directly related that infectious molecular clone, that strain. So what, as the negative studies came up, they would target their assays only to detect that strain, VP62. And that's all we were, and so Joy Dasgupta is the name of the scientist who did the sequencing in Bob Silverman's lab at the Cleveland Clinic. And he, by the fourth time, he told Dr. Rossetti, or he told us that one more sample, one more try, and then we'll give up. It's not that virus. And lo and behold, this time he found our samples were, in fact, the virus we isolated, he sequenced as VP62. It was closest related to, and VP62 means virus from prostate cancer from patient number 62. But again, they only had pieces. We had the whole virus. And as the tests were tailored, the negative studies towards that virus, and this particularly the serology test, it was very clear VP62 was never in humans. It never was the virus. They had the patent with Abbott Labs and at the time. So in fact, it was in their interest to continue saying they had discovered XMRV when in fact we had discovered XMRVs. There were many strains. And so by the time that was realized in 2011, that was the partial retraction. It was very clear from all of the science. So we all, everyone on the paper, agreed that figure one was wrong, the PCR was wrong, that testing was wrong, and in fact, we had actually discovered XMRVs, and it was a family of multiple strains, and it not only came from mice, but there were monkey, there were mink cell focus forming, so other small animals that had these families of gamma retroviruses, they're called. So the partial retraction was accepted by the journal. And again, this didn't play well because the blood supply was so heavily contaminated. So we continued to refuse to publish fraudulent studies and say our studies were wrong. So they forced the retraction after I was held in jail. So they held me in jail, and the other authors were lost confidence because of the sheer bizarre events of putting somebody in jail, accusing her of being a fugitive from justice with no charges behind it. Oh, the mysterious, did the notebooks go here or there? So it was that circus where Science, the journal, told Dr. Rossetti that they'd lost confidence and they were going to force the retraction. But at that time, neither Frank nor my two students who had done all the work, we still refused to retract it. But Dr. Rossetti and the other co-authors, of course, did not want to lose their careers.
Who is Ian Lipkin, and what was his role in regards to your paper in Science? Did you, in fact, acknowledge at some point, as the journal Science now maintains, that his findings were correct and, quote, that there was no evidence that XMRV is a human pathogen? Did you ever say that at any point?
The word I used was it. And it goes exactly to the story. So W. Ian Lipkin is the doctor who led the multi-center study. He was assigned when Francis Collins on September 6 ordered Dr. Fauci to fund a multi-center study, a large study to show the association. Nobody ever denied the existence, the association with chronic fatigue syndrome. Ian Lipkin was made the senior investigator in charge of the study. And so this is what I just said a few minutes ago. During the meeting to set the funding and set the study design, that was held November 4th, 2010, and the dates matter because on November 4th, 2010, a lot of the data suggested there was something wrong with VP62. But because the title of our paper said XMRV in our science paper, and the only sequence that was reported in that paper was the synthetic clone that we now know wasn't the virus and never was the virus, that was the only thing that we could find in the multi-center study. But in fact, our assays did find positive samples, and again, this is where Tony Fauci stopped the study. So the study design set November 4th, 2010. You cannot veer from that study or it's considered fraud. They veered in several respects from that study in that Harold Varmus, then the director of Nobel laureate Harold Varmus, then the director of the National Cancer Institute, and my colleague Dr. Rossetti's boss, so Dr. Rossetti was also on these publications, had insisted that the VP62 infectious molecular clone be put into a number of the samples, and the investigators not told about that. So he limited our ability to do our cultures because the contamination would spread, and then they would say it was contamination when we found that positive. So again, that's one study, part of it that's fraud. The rest of it is that, again, they had no legitimate groups. They didn't have chronic fatigue syndrome with the inflammatory signaling and the epigenetic problems, which was our basis. We had immunological proof, just like we see today, the cytokine signature of the disease of the infection of SARS-CoV-2. So the patient populations weren't correct. When we got to the end, Fauci stopped the study. They applied statistics, and Ian Lipkin told me and Dr. Rossetti, look, we need to put this to bed. Everybody knows it's not VP62. Everybody knows there never was any evidence of VP62. That's the only thing you can call XMRV. That was the title of your paper. That was Bob Silverman. Those were the data that were partially retracted in June of 2011. So this study was most of the winter and the summer of 2012. So at the end of the day, as we sat in the press conference, and unblinded the study. We unblinded the study in the middle of the summer. It was published. It wasn't published in Science. It was published in a journal called MBio. And that study was published September and October issue in 2012. So he applied the statistics when Tony Fauci stopped the study, and he told me and Frank in email and other places, we all need to put this in bed. And John Coffin, who wrote that accompanying article, said earlier that year, it's clear there are many strains of gamma retroviruses, just not that one. And so because we've gathered as a part of this important study, thousands of samples now of CFS patients, and we can really drill down on the other viruses and re-isolate the correct ones, you simply must say, because that was the study design, it's not there. I didn't say they're not there, and I was not aware of the sentence in the abstract that said there's no evidence anywhere, because table 3 said clearly 6.1% of the viruses in the patients and the controls. So that's it. I made the quote because I was told we only could look for VP62 by W. Ian Lipkin, and of course he committed the rest of the fraud with applying the statistics.
You know, we did a recent interview with an independent journalist named Sam Husseini, and in that interview he revealed that Ian Lipkin, your old friend, was one of the, first of all, he was one of the consultants on the film Contagion. I don't know if you know that. And he has also been very vocal in denying the possibility that SARS-CoV-2 could have been released from a lab accidentally or otherwise. What, can you just give us more of a sense of who he is? What interest would he have in protecting the idea, whether it's the Wuhan lab or the lab, you know, Fort Detrick or wherever? Is there what interest might he have in protecting the idea that this could have been a kind of a gain of function experiment gone wrong or intentional?
Well, because, you know, Ian Lipkin, in September and October of 2012, right after he made certain that the XMRVs were dead and gone, I think according to Science Journal, he was awarded $34 million by Tony Fauci to create the Center for Diagnostics and Discovery. And since that time, he has used that money in collaboration with the Barrick Lab in North Carolina with the Chinese at Wuhan, accelerating that work causing the cell lines that these animal tissues that the virus, the coronaviruses are grown in, happen to be the same cell lines, the VIRO-E6, the VIRO monkey kidney cells that carried those XMRVs into humans, among several cell lines, as we discussed earlier. So his interest is in covering up and burying, literally calling COVID-19 those 50 million Americans. He knows those, forget CFS Association, those 4 to 8% that were infected by contaminated blood supply and vaccines that are not necessarily asymptomatic carriers but have these diseases. They will die, they will be buried if COVID, nobody will do a test, and nobody will ever see that in fact that the carrier passengers along in those SARS coronavirus discoveries in those cultures and those vats, they grew the virus and changed the virus, were those very viruses that we discovered and associated with the diseases, the neuroimmune disease, the cancer. Those are the clinical symptoms we're seeing right now that are being COVID-19. This is a cover-up. They will bury them, and they can say, just as they cleaned up the blood supply after 2011, because when I identified the contaminated blood supply, I also identified that there was a way to clean it up. So they didn't have to worry about the blood supply, and the people on those papers were paid off tens of millions of dollars to clean up the blood supply and oh so quietly say, yeah, Judy Mikovits is crazy. It was never contaminated. Yeah, the data don't support that. It was contaminated, and that's proof in our new book, Plague of Corruption, with both of our books have thousands of references, even including emails between Tony Fauci and Ian Lipkin, essentially making those quid pro quo deals that I mentioned, where we were told everybody knows there are more gamma retroviruses there, Judy. Just put to bed VP62. It never was that, as they twisted this fraud. So I believe this is a cover up of the XMRVs, and they're growing them in the same animal tissue cell lines, and they have since the beginning, since 13, since 14, and he's funding those studies, those very pathways I identified, those paradigm shifting pathways of epigenetics and DNA methylation, and how viruses are silenced and how they're activated, exactly as we just discussed. All of these natural things that we do prevent the activation, and he's covering up the literally burying again the patients he's already injured. It's interesting to note that the confirmatory study of our work, our 2008 publication, which similar to the Semmelweis situation, it was greeted with great fanfare. And then in Science, the journal even published an editorial saying, oh, how wonderful this is. One new virus, how many old diseases? And this was authored by John Coffin, who is in the National Academy of Sciences. So there was great fanfare, and when the extent of the injuries, with the extent of the diseases, the association, and showing that in fact the contaminated blood supply was a primary source, and principally that the infection in the United States was 25 to 40 times the height of HIV during the AIDS epidemic, and that was only a million Americans, and I say only a million Americans in 1991. So what Harvey Alter and colleagues and Shai-Shing Lo had done when our paper published was they went back to a box that they'd had in the freezer since the early days of HIV, when patients with women and children and others who didn't fit the demographic, the susceptibility group of AIDS, HIV AIDS, which was called gay-related immune deficiency, and it was men, IV drug users, prostitutes. Here were, family, women, and children, and Shai-Shing Lo pulled the box out of the freezer, did the exact testing that we had done, and his boss there, he was at the FDA, and his boss was Harvey Alter, who has a Lasker Award. That's the American equivalent of the Nobel Prize. And so they found 86% of the people with CFS, they used to call it non-HIV AIDS, because they didn't fit the patient population, and clearly there was no evidence of HIV. So he had announced and published his study in the journal PNAS, the Proceedings of the Academy of Sciences, which is also the National Academy of Sciences, which is also a premier journal in the world. So here within 6 months of our publication is a confirmatory study that's even bigger. And more importantly, the control group in that situation from samples from the early 90s, the control group was 7% infected. And so now we know that the blood supply has been contaminated since the 90s, and it hadn't been cleaned up because it's only checked for HIV. And so now there's another family of viruses that spread around the world unchecked for 30 or 40 years. So Harvey Alter was also encouraged to withdraw his study. They didn't force its retraction, and he did withdraw it. And the reason why he withdrew it is because he had no more samples. So he had no more of that box, and in order to replicate his work, he had to use the same samples. So you see, our work was confirmed, and around the world it was extended. And then when the evidence became so great of a number of diseases that are associated, and the disease that probably was the straw that broke the camel's back for me, as I gave a talk at Columbia to an expert on a disease called ITP, which is idiopathic thrombocytopenia. It's a platelet disorder, a bleeding disorder. And ITP is long associated with fatigue and some of the things we see in patients with chronic fatigue syndrome. So in that study by the world's expert in that group who provided us the samples, we found more than 30% of people with ITP had, in fact, evidence of the mouse, the XMRV infections. And what's important about that is ITP is listed as a side effect on MMR vaccine. So we now have more evidence for injury and the development of cognitive and learning disorders from ITP. And I gave that talk in New York June 1st of 2011, and it was, other than the September 22nd talk, it was the last talk of my professional career.
How has this recent firestorm, I mean, you've been through them before, but this is a pretty big one. How has it affected you? How are you bearing up under all this?
This is absolutely nothing compared to false arrest, jailing, losing everything, being forced into bankruptcy under threat of going back to jail, being silenced from 2011 to 15, doing a replication study that mattered to 25 million Americans, and doing it by telephone, and then having Fauci stop the study, convince Dr. Hansen, convince Dr. Rossetti, oh, it has to be contamination, voodoo, oh, all the samples, all the centers were equally represented. That was pure hell. This is nothing. They have no new, you know, come on, come up with something. Prove you didn't falsely arrest me. Go to the NIH. I went there November 15th of 2016. It still says Judy Mikovits is a fugitive from justice. Who put that on? You know, they're running scared because I can still prove everything except figure one in that paper is right and true to this day. And I have every sample to prove it. It's in the last chapter of the book. They think they confiscated everything, but they forgot that mentor of 37 years had to have every copy of data that I've ever worked on. And we do. And we're exposing this plague of corruption. And this is the fun part, except for we've got to stop the plague of corruption that is COVID-19.
What would it require? What would it take for you to expand and continue the work that you were doing before?
Well, I mean, we've never stopped working. So I continue to make therapeutics. I continue to work with patients. I continue to look for adverse events. We've had a small consulting company since 2015, since I was allowed to enter back into work. We've served as expert witnesses in vaccine court for many years so we can start to see the injuries and who's susceptible and how to heal. So we've developed those formulations with natural products, including cannabis, and mixing them with therapeutics. We can heal all this right now. We could make a safe vaccine. We can continue to make the safe immune therapies I made my entire life. So I haven't stopped. I don't need to be in a lab. You know, I have a brain.